This summer, I'm shopping the small space solutions that America waited 250 years for at Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has everything from retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, party-ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish and space-conscious Bobopedic sofas to feature-packed power recliners that let me kick back all summer long. So, when you're ready to snag latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
From a hollowed-out military showcase in the heart of Moscow to an unauthorized desert outpost in Iraq, the world's most dangerous fault lines are shifting in the shadows. Welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Kervin. And this week, we are dissecting a global landscape defined by paranoia and high-stakes gambles. In Russia, the mythology of invincibility is crumbling as a terrified Kremlin purges its own elite and floats phantom peace deals to fracture Western unity. But the epicenter of our immediate crisis lies in the Persian Gulf, as a punishing U.S. naval blockade pushes Iran's oil infrastructure to the brink. Frantic backdoor diplomacy has reached Miami, where the fate of the Strait of Hormuz hangs in the balance. Meanwhile, halfway across the world, Beijing is orchestrating a silent political warfare campaign, weaponizing African airspace and Taiwanese domestic politics to set the stage for a decisive 2028 showdown. Are we watching the desperate thrashing of isolated regimes or the calculated opening moves of a new global order? Let's get into the state of play. We will start, as always, with an update on the never-ending special military operation in Ukraine. And look, I keep getting stuck on the visual from Red Square in Moscow this week. It's supposed to be this massive projection of strength, and instead, there wasn't a single tank.
Yeah, exactly. There were just soldiers. And for a state like Russia, built so heavily on the mythology of military invincibility, pulling the hardware from your most important national holiday, that's a huge tell for me. They simply do not have the assets to spare, but also they didn't want the optics of old, retired Soviet-era equipment.
Exactly. The modern military assets are all tied down or destroyed on the front lines, and the retired equipment would warrant questions the Kremlin is not willing to answer. But it's not just the missing hardware. I mean, they literally shut down mobile internet for their own citizens in major cities just to get through a parade.
Yeah, like the domestic security apparatus in Russia is incredibly jumpy right now, and they're terrified of Ukrainian drone strikes. That I'm sure about. But shutting down the grid is also about controlling the narrative. They know domestic fatigue is setting in.
They didn't want all those internet posts about how crappy their parade was, probably. All the tweets.
No, they didn't. And the mill blogger, like, we're talking about, like, the mill bloggers on Telegram who were 100% in support of all of this, who have now turned on the Kremlin.
Okay, so that obviously makes Putin's comment to reporters very, very fascinating. Standing there after a visibly weakened parade and saying he thinks the conflict is, quote, coming to an end, end quote. So do we actually buy that, or is he just trying to give hope?
Yeah, I think we run this through a competing hypothesis framework. You really have two ways to read this. One is that he's genuinely looking for an off-ramp because the domestic pressure and the economic realities here are finally hitting him too hard.
And the other?
Well, the other is that he senses a shift in the Western political winds, and he's trying to lock in the territorial gains that he already holds. So he's floating the idea of peace, but strictly on his terms.
Right, like demanding to negotiate with Gerhard Schroeder. I mean, bringing a former German chancellor who is deeply tied to Russian energy back into the mix feels like a very calculated attempt to fracture European unity.
It absolutely is. And you can see this friction that it's causing. You've got the EU Council president suddenly talking about discussing Europe's future security architecture with Russia. That makes a lot of people in Eastern Europe very nervous.
But then you throw Washington back into the middle of it. we just saw this three-day ceasefire brokered by the White House, and it actually held enough to get through the holiday.
Yeah, it did. And the broader shift here is the mediation style. The U.S. is signaling they won't waste time if there isn't real movement. And that puts a lot of pressure on both Kyiv and Moscow to at least look like they're willing to deal.
Right. And part of that deal was supposed to be a massive prisoner swap, 2,000 people going home. But Putin is already saying they haven't heard from Ukraine on it, which just feels like the usual stalling tactics. Putin knows he needs an off-ramp here, right? I mean, I don't want to derail the conversation here, but I think we need to discuss how this latest reporting on a possible planned coup ties into Putin's messaging over the weekend. I know sometimes news on Russia, especially about Putin, can read like tabloid trash, but these reports coming out of the Kremlin right now, it's not just the standard palace intrigue that we usually see. It feels like the walls are actually closing in on Putin. But I'm struggling to tell if he's actually in danger or if he's just lost his own head.
Yeah, and that's the big question, isn't it? You bring up a good point. A lot of things that we read in Western media coming out of Russia does read a lot like a tabloid, even in things like the BBC or the New York Times. And when you look at it through the lens of a paranoia feedback loop, for the intelligence community, the so what here isn't necessarily about a gunman in the hallway. It's about the total paralysis of the state of Russia.
Right, because if he's actually spending weeks in a bunker and using pre-recorded footage for the public, he's not actually leading. He's just surviving. And that's a massive shift from the unitary arbiter image that he's spent 27 years building.
Yeah, exactly. And that arbitration, that's the glue here. Usually he's the one who stops the different clans, those security guys, and then you've got those money guys. He stops them from killing each other. He tries to kill them, right? Or it's a suicide, jumping from a 30-story hospital.
Drowning off your boat when you fall off your boat and you drown, and or you get poisoned. Oops.
These oligarchs, they just don't know how to survive, right? And the thing that's interesting to me here is that if Putin is too scared to even sit at the same table as these security guys and these oligarchs, they start acting independently.
And that's where this Shoigu situation gets so interesting. I mean, they used to go on fishing trips together, and now the intel is basically labeling him a coup risk. Is that actual evidence of a plot, or is it just the regime eating itself?
I think it's likely both here. I mean, we can't discount a coup attempt from one of Putin's closest allies. Look, you know, look at what happened with Prigozhin, right? He all of a sudden just attempted a coup, and then he ended up, you know, tragically dying in an accident, a plane accident. I'm doing quotes here for anyone who can't see. This wasn't a hospital there. This was a tragic plane accident. But there always seems to be this triggering event. And when you arrest someone like Selikov, that's Shoigu's right-hand man here, you're breaking the mafia code that keeps the elite loyal. So once you stop protecting your own, Putin here not protecting his own security apparatus, everyone else starts looking for the exit. Or the most dangerous thing for Putin, they're looking for a new boss.
Which makes total sense when you look at the economy, too. I mean, we're seeing reports of an actual recession now. Obviously, they're not openly saying this, but if the cake is shrinking, as some of these experts say, then being loyal to Putin isn't as profitable as it used to be.
And we all know what happens when you say, let them eat cake, right? A little French Revolution there. I think the economy is always the breaking point here. And the elite have stayed quiet because it was safer and richer to be with Putin than to be against Putin. But if the war is a deadlock and drones are hitting Moscow high-rises and the money's drying up, the math changes.
And with the Victory Day parade being scaled back, to put it mildly, it must feel to them as if this is some sort of public admission of weakness. It's like they're saying, we can't even protect ourselves in the heart of the Capitol.
Right. It's a pragmatic choice that carries a terrible message. So you're trading your most important propaganda moment for just a little bit of physical security. And it signals to every mid-level bureaucrat that Moscow is not holding right now.
It kind of makes you wonder if the paranoia itself is the weapon. Some people are saying this intel leak is just a psyop to make the Kremlin spin out of control.
Yeah, and honestly, it doesn't even matter if the coup threat is real or if it's just some ghost theory out there. If Putin believes that it's real, he's going to keep purging his best people and hiding in bunkers. And a paranoid leader who doesn't trust his generals, it's a leader who can't win a war of attrition.
And speaking of paranoid leaders, let's get into the Iran discussion. When you read through the latest updates on these negotiations, I get this sense that we're watching two entirely different realities. The U.S. is leaking that a ceasefire memo is right around the corner, but Iran's public messaging is completely dismissing it.
Right. And that disconnect is exactly what you'd expect when both sides are playing to completely different strategic objectives. Now, Iran isn't just trying to survive this war anymore. They've shifted gears. They want to emerge from this with a completely new power dynamic in the region.
Which makes sense when you think about what they actually look like on the water. We're not just talking about surviving sanctions, are we?
Yeah, no, not at all. Their ultimate prize right now is getting the U.S. to formally recognize Iranian sovereignty over the Strait of Hormuz. Now, if Iran gets that, they can legally intercept ships, they can charge tolls, and basically hold global markets hostage whenever they feel threatened. Everyone wants to talk about who's winning this and who's losing this. Well, that's going to be a massive win for Iran.
And that is because it completely neutralizes the sanctions. If every shipping company has to pay Iran in their own currency just to get through the strait, they're basically forcing the world to break the U.S. blockade for them.
Exactly. This acts as an insurance policy against future wars with the U.S. or Israel. But right now, the reality on the ground is hitting Iran hard. The naval blockade has forced dozens of ships to turn around, and they're actually running out of physical space to store their unsold oil.
I mean, if they run out of storage in a matter of weeks, the economic fallout inside Iran is going to be pretty brutal, right? I mean, how is the regime not buckling under that pressure? Because usually that's the tipping point for massive protests.
Yeah, and the regime knows this. But instead of conceding at the negotiating table, they're preparing for a severe domestic crackdown. They're telling their officials to brace for jihadi management, mobilizing the besieged militias into the various neighborhoods. And they're doing this to crush any dissent before it spirals out of control.
So they're willing to absorb the pain at home if it buys them time to get this deal. And the deal they want includes unlocking billions in frozen assets. But what do they actually do with that cash if they do get it?
Well, the first thing is they're not going to give it to the people. And I think that's the problem there. What they're really going to do is they're going to rebuild their ballistic missile program. A lot of those production facilities were hit hard during the initial strikes there in the conflict. So getting economic relief isn't about feeding the populace here. It's about getting the steel and development facilities back online so that they can rearm.
Which brings us to these quiet talks in Miami. You've got Secretary Rubio and White House envoy Steve Witkoff huddling with the Qatari prime minister. So why is Qatar suddenly pulling so much weight behind the scenes while Pakistan is the official mediator?
I think it's because the White House knows Qatar actually gets results in Tehran. The Qatari prime minister was supposed to fly straight back to Doha after seeing Vice President J.D. Vance, but he detoured to Miami instead. That to me really shows the urgency here.
And it's not just Qatar pushing for this, right? You've got Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, all working in tandem. It feels like the entire region is collectively holding its breath, trying to force a de-escalation before Iran's oil storage maxes out.
Yeah, and that makes the terms of this supposed one-page memo that the U.S. sent out very critical. Now, we've seen the leaked version of this, which talks about a 12 to 15-year pause on nuclear enrichment for Iran. But then you have, as always, President Trump publicly demanding that Iran give up highly enriched uranium entirely and shut down underground sites permanently.
And that gap between a temporary pause and total capitulation is massive. It really makes you wonder what the Saudi foreign minister was thinking when the Qatari PM called him from Miami, because no matter what the Saudi foreign minister is thinking about this potential ceasefire, they also have to be looking over their shoulder at how completely porous the region's borders have become. I mean, like, look at this new reporting about Israel setting up an entire secret military base right in the middle of the Iraqi desert.
Right, and we aren't talking about a temporary outpost here. The Israelis moved in special forces, they moved in search and rescue teams. This was all right before the air campaign kicked off against Iran, and it was this massive logistical safety net just in case an Israeli pilot went down over hostile territory.
Which is kind of wild when you think about the sheer audacity of it. You're putting boots on the ground in a country that is heavily influenced by Iran, and you're doing it completely under the radar of their own government.
Right, but it shows Israel's operational calculus here. They clearly decided that the nightmare scenario of an Israeli pilot being captured, whether it's in Tehran or even in Iraq, outweighed the diplomatic risk of secretly squatting in Iraq. Now, honestly, it almost blew up in their faces when actual Iraqi forces stumbled upon that clandestine secret site.
Okay, so how does Baghdad even process this level of violation against their sovereignty? And are they going to, I mean, they're not going to let them stay there, are they?
No, I mean, absolutely not. And initially, they just blamed the U.S., right? They assumed it was a reckless, unapproved U.S. operation that poured more gasoline on an already volatile dynamic. But it would make sense because the U.S. still operates outposts in that country. And so what we are learning through open source now is that even the U.S. was completely out of the loop on this specific Israeli base.
That has to be incredibly frustrating for the U.S. personnel on the ground there. They're already constantly getting targeted by these powerful Iranian-backed militias trying to hit the embassy and the airport, and now they're catching the blame for covert military missions.
Yeah, and this is how the fog of war works, right? So only time brings the truth to light here, and for Iraq, they're wedged directly between all these major players. They're desperately trying to walk a tightrope between Tehran and Washington, D.C. And there's a lot of talk about sovereignty here, with the Israelis doing something on sovereign Iraqi land. But the reality is they have almost zero sovereignty over their own airspace. They don't have any sovereignty on their own remote deserts. They have handed all of that to both the U.S. and also Iran.
So if you're the Iraqi government, you're basically a hostage in your own living room. You've got Iranian proxies launching attacks, the U.S. firing back at those proxies, and Israel secretly setting up staging grounds in your backyard.
Right. It's that sense of your borders becoming suggestions rather than barriers. Hello, Ukraine, right? This is a total loss of agency when the big players here, U.S., Israel, Iran, those are the ones that are deciding your geography, and they are playing in your playground.
Which is exactly what makes the news coming out of the Indo-Pacific, and weirdly Africa, so unsettling. It's that same feeling of being squeezed by a much larger hand. And I was scrolling through the headlines last week, and that story about the Taiwanese president's flight being blocked in Africa felt like a personal move to me. I mean, to have three different countries pull your overflight right at the very last minute, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's a massive public snub. And that means it's a message. Honestly, it's about as clear a message as you can send in the world of diplomacy without actually firing a shot.
Right. But it's not just about the flight path. It feels like this broader, really aggressive squeeze. But then on the flip side, you see the opposition leader from Taiwan over in Beijing getting the full red carpet treatment from Xi. The contrast is just wild.
Yeah, and it's totally intentional here. So what we're seeing isn't just a random set of events. I think everybody understands that this is a highly calibrated political warfare campaign. Beijing is basically auditioning for the 2028 election in Taiwan right now.
That's the so what here, isn't it? It's not about a single trip being canceled. It's about Beijing trying to show the Taiwanese voters that life under the current administration is a dead end, while life with the opposition is paved with trade deals. It changes the calculus of when an invasion of Taiwan may happen, but it's a bit of a gamble for Xi, isn't it? We see President Trump using this carrot stick tactic against Iran, but we are seeing if you lean too hard on the stick side of things, you risk just making the public more resentful. Or am I missing something here?
No, I think you're absolutely right. You're not wrong here. But Xi is actually betting on exhaustion. He's betting that by 2028, the average person is going to be so tired of the tension, all this talk about when China will invade Taiwan, all this economic friction, that the peace and stability narrative starts to look like the only rational choice left.
And that makes the internal politics in Taiwan even messier. I've been seeing reports about the opposition actually trying to block defense spending. If I'm looking at this through your lens, that's not a budget debate. That's a strategic move.
Oh, yeah, you nailed it on that one for sure. If Beijing can help a partner get into power who's already stalling on defense, they've essentially won without a single ship leaving the port. They're trying to make sure that by the time the election happens, Taiwan's ability to actually say no to unification is physically weakened.
Which is why that Africa situation was so telling. If the U.S. couldn't even convince a few small nations to let a plane through, it suggests the influence Beijing has built through all of those trade deals is starting to outweigh traditional Western diplomacy.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been talking about this, I think, from episode one, right? The importance that the African continent is playing here in geopolitics. And we look at the current state of affairs there, and most are going to wonder, like, how did this happen overnight? And I'm here to say it didn't. This is over a decade of influence campaigns on the continent. This is a long game. Xi has tied this to his entire legacy.
So if 2028 comes and the voters don't take the bait, what's the pivot? Does the carrot just disappear entirely?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt the unification by force plan will become the reality by then. So if China feels like the political path is officially dead, so this diplomacy path that they're trying out right now, then all that military hardware they've been building up stops being a backup plan. And it starts being the only plan left on the table.
What year did you say that you thought China was going to invade Taiwan? Didn't you say 26 or 27?
It's wavering between 26 and 27, right?
And now we're saying 28?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like that's the way that China's playing it right now. And you think about how the U.S. has kind of changed, right, since before 2024.
I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, we don't. No one wants to talk about it.
I want to talk about it.
But, you know, this all started a decade ago as the 2030 plan, right? And they want unification by 2030. And we kind of been wavering back and forth. I don't think it's set in stone right now. And you've heard me waver on this. So I think that's where I'll pause and just, like, it's likely right now that 2028 could be a year that changes things.
Because they're trying to go through elections instead of invading Taiwan.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is, what are they seeing, right, from an intelligence perspective? So do they see that there is a pathway to do this? Without bloodshed? That's what they want, right? Read The Art of War. You want to win without firing a single weapon.
Yeah.
So do they see an avenue here, or is this a last-ditch effort? Is this all of the generals converging on Xi and saying, you're going to have to wait. We don't want to make any moves until we take this one last effort. And we'll see how it plays out.
All right. Well, I'm just saying you didn't change your timeline on here. So now this is you changing your timeline from, because you went 26 and you were like, no, 27. Now you're like 28. But obviously.
Yeah. And then it'll be 29.
And it'll be 20. We'll just keep pushing it back. I mean, that's better than having it happen, I guess.
Absolutely. I would rather just keep pushing this back and be wrong on all of this. I want it to be wrong about Russia. And I hope I'm wrong about this and that cooler heads prevail.
Well, 2028 is emerging to be yet another pivotal year of elections, but it unfolds in a vastly different climate. What we witnessed in 2024 was the changing of the tides, a shift that has now brought in the era of predictable geopolitics to a definitive end. We are now operating in a reality where the absence of a tank in Red Square is just as significant as a canceled flight path over the African continent. The leverage being tested right now is incredibly volatile. If the secret negotiations in Florida fail to produce a breakthrough, Iran's overflowing oil reserves could trigger a brutal domestic crackdown and ignite a broader conflict over the world's most critical maritime choke point. And with Israel operating covertly in Iraq without Washington's knowledge, the margin for error in the Middle East has completely evaporated. Whether it is a paranoid leader hiding from his own generals in Moscow, or Xi Jinping playing a long game of political exhaustion ahead of 2028, the next major global conflict won't necessarily start with an invasion. It will start when these fragile systems finally snap. And as always, we'll be right there tracking every fracture. And before we sign off, is there anything else you'd like to discuss?
No.
Really?
Just kidding. Yeah, so we've been sitting on this news for a week now, but we are officially no longer a podcast. We're not the geopolitical podcast This Week Explained. We are the award-winning geopolitical podcast This Week Explained.
Yeah,
we have won. Yes, through all the cheering now.
Yeah.
But we found out that we were nominated and we had won the PopCon Best News Podcast of the Year. And that entailed entertainment news, political news, and breaking news.
Oh, really? I didn't. Okay. So it covered all the bases.
All of them in our podcast is the one that won. There were many nominees. I only know of the three nominees. They only posted like the top three nominees, which we were. And
that's wild. Yeah, we didn't even know we were nominated, but we're just grateful we were nominated and we won. We won.
Yeah, very, very grateful. The cool. Judges over at PopCon, I'm just, we're, say grateful again, right? But that's really the only word I can think of right now, because we just had no idea.
Like, or expectation to ever win any.
Right, like, yeah, and that's.
I don't know if y'all remember the early days of this podcast, but we used to do it drinking, and it was a mess because we never thought we would be taken seriously or anything, you know?
Yeah, we knew we had like serious information
right
to present. We were trying to present it in a different way that it wasn't so heavy. But then the world got really heavy.
Yeah, we figure we better straighten out. So it's just crazy.
Yeah, and I think some of that is like there's so much chaos out there of like podcasts just saying anything and, you know, tweets and Instagram reels and TikToks that you can just say whatever. And people are like, oh, that must be true. This person is saying it. I think we figured like if we're here a little bit inebriated talking about this stuff, it's like, oh, well, they don't know what they're talking about. They're just having fun.
And we were.
Yeah, we absolutely were. And we still have fun being able to talk through these things with each other. But with the, we're trying to bring levity to the situation. And there are times you can't do that in those moments that we were having.
Yeah, we went on too many tangents. It was, our stream of consciousness was not a simple one to follow for sure. But yeah, because things got a little crazier, we figured we better deliver the message more clearly and concisely. More importantly, concisely, because we got pretty verbose.
I mean, I'm sure people, maybe they can't see it now, but like some of those episodes were an hour and a half long.
Jesus.
Same amount of information that we were trying to present.
Amount of information, just a bunch of, you know, stories that we thought tied in, you know, just whatever. Anyway, now we're serious. We've got a big boy podcast now.
We do. We have to put our big boy pants on and actually present factual information now.
We always presented factual information, Kervin. Oh, jeez.
This is true.
Anyway, once again, thank you so much for that. This is very exciting for us. We never thought something like that would happen, but thank you. Do you have anything else you want to say, or are you done?
I'm trying. I know that, well, this is a little bit delayed, but we're gonna keep consistent. So don't let this delay fool you. We'll be consistent.
Yeah. It's Nova traffic. The traffic here has been so bad lately that it's kept me in it for a lot longer than I should have been. A 15-minute drive turned into an hour drive yesterday. And today...
And Sunday was Mother's Day, and I'm not going to have you recording.
Yeah, because I'm a mother.
Yep. Thank Some you. Would say the mother.
No, not really, but you know, but yeah, I appreciated the day off. Anyways, we have been yapping enough. I think it's time we let our lovely listeners go continue their days.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to This Week Explained. We hope that you found it both informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, we would love to hear from you. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and more, be sure to follow us on social media at This Week Explained.
Deanna, thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.
Little Bob here. This summer, shop the latest small space solutions at Bob's Discount Furniture. From retro chic bedroom sets to stylish space-conscious Bob-o-pedic sofas, it's all at Bob's, where America shops for furniture.